Hello, Robert P. Jones, rock star.
Hi there.
I can't hear you. Can let me see what's going on here. Will you help?
Testing.
Can you hear me?
1, 2, 3. I can hear you. Yep.
Yeah, I can have your volume. I think it's just your volume.
We're trying to get the kinks out. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, you can?
Yeah.
I can hear you just great.
Okay, good.
Hey, man, thanks so much. Where are you right now?
I'm at home.
In Virginia or D.C.?
Maryland.
Maryland.
Yep, just across the line, Tacoma Park.
Hey, thanks so much for being here. As I mentioned to you last night, we have a really large group of online participants, many of whom are coming from the UVA Engagements Program. We'll get started presently with just a brief intro, 40 minutes or so of you, another half hour, Q&A, and, you know, our end time is around 4:45. And if we need to go a few minutes over, just send me an invoice. We'll take care of it.
It's time and a half, right? After half, totally.
It is a joy to welcome you today to the University of Virginia and to this particular class, Religion 5009, I think, Theologies of Resistance and Reconciliation, in which we have explored this and related themes around five central figures, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Reinhold Niebuhr, Martin Luther King Jr., Dorothy Zola, and then the great Robert P. Jones. And so you're in good company here. All of you who are coming online as guests, welcome. You are joining a seminar in progress. Alas, this is our final day of the fall semester, Robert. And on these times when we have visiting speakers, and Dr. Jones is the third of our series, we open up the class to a larger community. So welcome to all of you. Just briefly, a couple of words about Dr. Jones. Dr. Jones is the president and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute, which I strongly encourage you to visit online. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to conducting independent research and driving conversations at the intersection of religion, culture, and politics. He is a frequent on-air guest to television shows. You have likely read seen his editorials and essays in such places as The Atlantic, Religion News Services, Time Magazine, and other outlets. He's frequently featured in major news media, as I mentioned, such as CNN, MSNBC, SE, NPR, The New York Times, Washington Post, and others. Dr. Jones is also a New York Times bestselling author. I would want to mention and to strongly recommend as holiday reading his most recent book, The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to Shared American Future. Is that your most recent book, Robbie?
That's right. Yep. Just out last year.
Just out last year with Simon & Schuster. Who's your publisher?
That's right. Simon & Schuster. Yep.
As well as The End of White Christian America, which won the 2019 Graumeier Award. My hearty congratulations on that.
Yep. Thank you.
Extraordinary honor. The Graumeier Award is given every year to the most influential book written in religion in North America, and this is quite an extraordinary honor with a nice little purse alongside it. The book that we have read this week is an earlier book of yours called called White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity, and it's largely that book around which our conversation is convened this afternoon. It's an extraordinary book, and we'll have more time, you know, after the presentation to, we will have time after the presentation to ask some questions and make some comments. I would just say on a personal note that, you know, I'm 10 years older than you are, but I can't believe that we have never met each other. Our lives follow such similar narrative arcs. I mean, we both kind of grew up in the deep coastal South, but went to high school and junior high in Mississippi. I know Mississippi College well, your undergraduate alma mater. My uncle, the Baptist theologian Fisher Humphreys.
Was a
classics major at Mississippi College. And then he went on to New Orleans Baptist, and then he went on to Oxford. It's funny, 2 weeks ago, our second speaker was a theologian named Sarah Pennock, Dr. Sarah Pennock, who is the daughter of Clark Pennock, who you might recall.
Yep.
Who was taught at New Orleans Baptist back in the days. You went on from Mississippi College to Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, and then began a PhD at Emory, am I correct, when you were in your early 30s, and finished your doctorate there. Were you working with Ted Smith at Emory?
So I am proud to say that I helped recruit Ted Smith to graduate studies at Emory. He was 2 years behind me. But I was like actually paired with him when he came to visit campus. We hung out even before he was a student there. But he and I overlapped at Emory University in the graduate school.
And what was your dissertation on, Robbie?
That's funny. I don't ever get asked about that.
I'm kind of an academic nerd, and that's it.
Yeah, so I was in the program called Ethics and Society in the Graduate Division of Religion. And so it was this hybrid program between sociology of religion, theology, and law in a way. And so I was able to kind of do political theory and stuff. So my dissertation was on the debates over physician-assisted suicide in Oregon and the role that religion played in those debates. And I kind of looked at – that was the on-the-ground kind of sociological piece, but I married it up with a kind of argument in political theory with liberal political theorists like John Rawls and Ronald Dworkin as well.
Fantastic. I did not know that.
Yep.
You cover numerous competencies. There's so much more I could say, but let me just conclude by noting that I have learned so much from Dr. Jones's work. I don't know any author who has written more probingly, courageously, with unflinching honesty and attention, and just get deep in the weeds, like old school research, on the white supremacy in American Christianity than Dr. Jones. And we are honored to have you here today virtually at UVA and look forward to your presentation.
Well, thanks so much. I'm really just honored to be there. And I couldn't make it in person, but I'm happy to be here virtually with you. Yeah, we got a great crowd here, it looks like, on the virtual participants. And thank you all for reading my book. It's when I saw the syllabus and the other folks you're reading, I mean, yeah, great company is a huge understatement compared to the folks you've been reading. So I'm just honored to be a part of the conversation. So I thought I'd say a little bit about just that trajectory of the last three books. In retrospect, you maybe think about the three books as a trilogy, but it was sort of an unintended trilogy. And, sometimes you get a hold of a problem and it has more of a hold of you than you have on it. And it has taken a while to kind of wrestle it to the ground. But it began. So the first book back in 2016 that I wrote as a popular book was, I called The End of White Christian America. And I was trying to just figure out, what was going on in that kind of 2014, 2015 era. This is before Donald Trump really comes on the scene. So it isn't really about that, but it is about a kind of anger and resentment that, I saw kind of welling up and kind of defensiveness about the changing demographics in the country, and anger about the changing demographics in the country. So that book was really a demographic book. And, you know, what I was looking at there was some early data from PRRI where I realized that we, you know, people were talking about, oh, well, in 2040, we'll be a majority non-white country. And that's like the thing out on the horizon that everybody's kind of watching for. But I realized that we had actually crossed, we'd already crossed a kind of cultural marker that I think was maybe even more important than that kind of one that's just about race or ethnicity. And that is that, you know, through most of the country's history, the kind of dominant cultural expression hasn't just been about race, but it's been about a kind of ethno-religious expression, a kind of Protestant Christian, white Protestant Christian dominant. Like we even have an acronym for that, like white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, a WASP. Right. And like the historian David Hollinger, you know, like one point said, look, if you were in charge of something big and important up until like the 1950s, the chances are you were white, you were Anglo-Saxon, and you were Protestant. That's just how the power structures ran in the country. So the first book was really looking at the fact that even as early as 2015, we had already crossed this threshold where we had ceased to be a majority white Christian country. And so that is, you take all white Christians together, Protestant, Catholic, non-denominational, all of them. We had gone just from in like very recently. So, you know, even if you go back to Barack Obama running for president in 2008, the country was still 54% white and Christian at that point. So still comfortably majority white and Christian. But just 8 years later, by the time his second term is finishing, we crossed that threshold. So we've moved from being a majority white Christian country, 54%, to, and the numbers I was looking at then, it went from 54% to 47% just over those 8 years. And that part of that, you know, was this symbolic presence of our first African-American president in the White House at the same time that the country has undergone this sea change from being a majority white Christian country, the one that's no longer majority white and Christian. So just kind of noting that kind of cultural shift was really what that first book was about, and kind of seeing underneath that a lot of, you know, what I've sometimes only half jokingly called the great white Christian freakout, you know, that we've been experiencing in the country in many ways, particularly among more conservative, like evangelical, you know, white Christians, which, you know, by the way, just in case you didn't catch it in the bio, I mean, these are my people. These are the group from which I come. I grew up Southern Baptist in Jackson, Mississippi. You know, my family is Baptist back 200 years into Middle Georgia. This is where my older roots are, in and around Bibb County. Baptist all the way back there. So, you know, these are deep, deep roots of my own. And then in the book that that you all read in the seminar there, it was kind of like, okay, well, if that's what's going on in the present, we're kind of this kind of freak out about this demographic shift and the fact that white Christians are no longer the majority in the country, and all the institutional shifts that are going on around that. What does that mean, right? And so part of what I did in White Too Long was to kind of delve into my own family's history. So it's a little more memoir. It's kind of part sociology, part memoir in that book, and you know, Charles took a page out of your own writing for that, you know, to kind of take seriously what does this feel like for me and my own family's history. And, you know, there I just to kind of give you two little markers for those who didn't read it. I have one of the oldest things I have in my possession from my mother's side of the family is a family Bible, and it goes all the way back. It was printed in 1815, and it was the Bible that my family on that side carried from Virginia down to Georgia, where they arrived somewhere around, you know, 1816, 1815, right after the Bible was printed. So it was a fairly new Bible that they brought down.
I don't mean to interrupt, but from Albemarle County, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, that's where we are.
That is true. Yeah, that's right. Well, there are some, the family name on that side is Moon. There's actually some moons in Albemarle County that we can still kind of trace back there. But the so that Bible, you know, was brought down, and It has, you know, in between the Old and New Testaments, about four generations of my family's ancestors, written births, deaths, marriages, and the like there. But the thing that struck me was that the other document I unearthed by doing some genealogical research was an estate settlement. The owner of the Bible, his name was Pleasant Moon. It's a British male name. And there's three or four Pleasant Moons. He was actually named after an uncle. And I found that uncle's, it's like my sixth great uncle, his estate settlement when he died. And it says the goods and chattels of Pleasant Moon, deceased 1815. And, you know, listed there are, you know, things like, you know, a feather bed, a table, six chairs, one bay mare, you know, six head of sheep, et cetera. But amid all these earthly goods are four human beings listed, right, by name, you know, and with a dollar amount out beside them. And then it goes on to list other things. And so part of that book was, I think, wrestling with, you know, this contradiction between, on the one hand, you know, or what should be a contradiction, but wasn't, I should say, you know, this family that so valued their faith that the one object that they passed down generation to generation was the family Bible, and passed that tradition down to me. And at the same time was a family who enslaved others, you know, based on the color of their skin, and saw no contradictions between, you know, that practice and this Bible, and this Christianity that they valued so much. So I spent a lot of time in that book kind of wrestling with that. And what I wanted to know there, as you know, kind of boil it down, was this question really of like, so what happens today? Like, what's the legacy of that today? Like, we, you know, we can kind of make that history alive, but how does it come down to us today? And I kind of want to ask the question of, well, if I use modern data and I take your average white American and add Christian identity, what effect does that have on their attitudes towards structural racism in the country? And for those of you who read the book, you know, you'll see kind of in the middle of the book, I kind of sort this all out. I came up with this thing called the Racism Index, where I measured people's attitudes around Confederate monuments, around the continued legacy of past discrimination and slavery, to unequal sentencing between black and white people accused of capital crimes, like all of that stuff together. And it turns out all those attitudes hang pretty well together and form one big index out of it. And to boil it down, what I found was this kind of shocking, shocking to those of us who grew up inside of it, because it's not what we like to think about the effects of white religion or white Christianity are. But I essentially found that if you take your average white American and you add Christian identity, they become more racist, not less. Right, that they actually that the effect of that is to move them up this racism scale, not down. And so if you ask, like, okay, who's closer to the attitudes of African Americans on issues of race and racism? It's not white Christians; it is white non-Christians who are the closest to those. And I boiled it down, you know, to try to really make it succinct. And I, you know, I remember one of the lines that I wrote in that book, where after I wrote it, I literally just had to push back from the desk and go for a walk, because I was just done for the day. But I realized that, you know, one way of saying this is that if you were recruiting for a white supremacist cause on a Sunday morning, you'd have better luck. Your odds would be better if you hung out in your average white church parking lot than if you approached whites who were sitting out of church in a coffee shop. And that's what the data, right, tells us about the way that this is functioned in there. So the third book, you know, that is kind of an unintended trilogy, is called The Hidden Roots of White Supremacy and the Path to a Shared American Future. That book came out a year ago, hardback, and just came out in paperback with a new afterword in September, end of September of this year. And what I was trying to do in that book is actually, okay, say if White Too Long took me kind of into the 1800s, how far back does this go? Like, if I want to trace back the kind of most proximate source to this infection of white supremacy in American Christianity, well, like, where's the best place to find that proximate cause? And so I did a lot more historical work in that book, really, than I've done in the previous books. And there, essentially what I did is I traced it back to, you know, you basically can see that, well, the version of Christianity that lands on these shores from Europe already has this idea of white supremacy baked into it, that it is tied up with the Atlantic slave transatlantic slave trade. All of that stuff is already built in. And so where does it go back to? And so I traced it in that book back to a set of papal bulls that get written. These are basically, you know, edicts from the Vatican, from the Pope at the time, who are trying to actually, you know, the kind of quote unquote discovery of these new lands created kind of a theological crisis in the European church, because it created, you know, this moral question. It's like, okay, well, what do we owe? What's our relationship between these people that we didn't know existed, these lands that we didn't know existed? How do we fit them into our moral and theological maps here? And so these papal bulls were essentially answering that question. And the way they answered that question was essentially with their own question. And the threshold question to get all the rest of the theological logic off the ground was, well, are these people, these newly discovered people, Christian? And of course, they knew the answer, right? So that the answer to that is no, they were not Christian. And then it just all follows from there, right? So if they're not Christian, they are to be considered, this is like in the documents, they're to be considered enemies of Christ, is the language that's used. It's kind of bellicose language. And then it just spells out in these Vatican documents that, and they were written explicitly to like Spain, Portugal, these early powers that were attempting kind of getting the whole colonial project off the ground to kind of give them moral permission. And in fact, the final one that's kind of considered part of this is called the Doctrine of Discovery, this set of papal bulls from between 1452 and 1493 is actually written in response to Columbus's first voyage. And it just spells out, right, these rights that, it, you know, that you, if they're not Christian, you have the right to take their land, take their goods. If they don't convert, and then you even have the right to, the language is to submit them to perpetual slavery, there is the lines in there. So this is the version of Christianity that lands on the shores. And I then just kind of think, okay, well, again, the question for me is, that's all, you know, kind of interesting history, but how much does it explain today? So I tried in that book to kind of take, again, up to today and see this idea of America as a promised land for European Christians, like how operative is that idea today, and how much work is it still doing today? So I'm going to show you just a few slides, and then I will. So I should stop when?
Oh, you've got 20 minutes.
Okay.
15 minutes, yeah.
Great. All right. So I'll just make sure I'm at 10 after I'm done. But
Yeah.
But I thought it'd be helpful to kind of show a few slides here to kind of give you a sense of how powerful, you know, these doctrines that are, you know, 500 years old, and that even though people don't know them by name, people can't cite them, they just the general ideas that they unleashed into the world are still very much with us today. So let me just kind of show you a few of these. This is data from very recent data from last year from Public Religion Research Institute. Here. And, you know, I could argue that this is really at the heart of what I half jokingly that thing about the great American white Christian freakout moment. But another way to think about this is kind of an identity crisis, you know, of America. Many Americans have thought of this country as a white Christian country. And if it's not that, what is it? And how do we wrap our heads around that? And I think this movement that we're talking about today as Christian nationalism is, you know, you can draw a pretty straight line between the ideas underneath that idea of Christian nationalism and this very old doctrine of discovery. So let me kind of just march through just a few things about how we're measuring Christian nationalism. So go from history to public opinion polling here and from, you know, kind of footnotes to percent signs. But one of the ways we measure a phenomenon that's abstract, like Christian nationalism, is to just essentially base it on some very specific questions. So we have, building on a bunch of work in political science and social sciences, We've kind of worked with these five questions. These are agree, disagree questions to measure whether people have this idea that the country should be a Christian nation. So everything from God has called Christians to exercise dominion over all Americans, all areas of American society, to the U.S. government should declare America a Christian nation. I won't read all of them here, but you can kind of see them here. And what we do is we basically take these together. And, you know, if you only score high on one, that doesn't sort of put you in the Christian nationalist category. So if you score high on like all of them, or if you score low on all of them, do you get kind of sorted into some categories that we can kind of then do some analysis with? So what does it look like if we basically sort people into four categories? We called Christian nationalism adherents. Those are people who basically completely agree with all five of those questions. Sympathizers are those who agree, but they don't completely agree. Skeptics are those who disagree, but not completely. And then rejectors are those who disagree with all five of those statements. And basically what we find is that about 3 in 10 Americans lean toward supporting some kind of Christian nationalism idea. They're either full-on adherents, about 1 in 10 are full-on adherents, and then 2 in 10 are sympathetic to that worldview. And then the other side of the question here is it's about 4 in 10 who are skeptics and about another 3 in 10 who are rejectors, right? So on the whole, it's really about a third, a little less than a third of the country that is sympathetic and about 2/3 of the country that is not sympathetic to that view. But these views are obviously they're not evenly distributed throughout the population. So even though it's kind of 2 to 1 rejecting that view, you'll see here in a minute how it shows up. But one of the ways we also test new scales and when we're doing composite measures like this is to see how well the composite measure lines up against other questions that are more straightforward measures of attitude. So here's two questions here that are not inside the scale, that are separate. But this first one is essentially a doctrine of discovery question. You agree or disagree that God intended America to be a new promised land where European Christians could create a society that'd be an example to the rest of the world. The second one, similar, I would prefer the U.S. to be a nation primarily made up of the people who follow the Christian faith. So these numbers I'm showing here are the percent in the population among all Americans who agree. So again, I'll bet 3 in 10. But when you put the correlations up here, you can really see it. If you look at those who are Christian nationalism adherents, it's more like 8 in 10 agree with that statement, which is what you'd expect. So this gives us some confidence that we're measuring a true orientation with that composite scale. And you see, as I add the other things here, it really is a linear measure. So this tells us we've probably got this right. We have some confidence that we've gotten this more composite measure right. So even among those who are just sympathetic, it's still 2/3 who kind of affirm that doctrine of discovery question. And it's a solid majority who still say they'd like to live in a country only made up of people who follow the Christian faith. So as I said, it's not evenly distributed. And one of the reasons why this view that, again, is kind of out of this 500-year-old legacy of kind of literally claiming the country, right, to be a kind of white Christian country, still has a lot of legs, is because it has become the majority view among self-identified Republicans today. And so you can see the real difference here between partisans. Here it's more than twice as many Republicans who hold this view as Democrats, and then you can also see that it correlates among those who had a favorable view of Trump versus Biden. Basically, it lines up with party as well. Again, just included that as an extra check. But this is kind of one of the things that we're dealing with, and part of the reason for this too is that the two political parties today have sorted themselves by race and religion. So it's fairly remarkable today that self-identified Republicans are 7 in 10 white and Christian, right? In a country, again, that's only about today, that number, by the way, the country today is only 41% white and Christian. And so Republicans are 70% white and Christian in a country that's only around 40% white and Christians. Democrats are only 25% white and Christian. So part of it is the demographics and the way the parties have sorted themselves as well here. The other thing to kind of point out here is that we do see this show up in some ways. There are non-white people who affirm Christian nationalism, but what we find is that among, like if you look at the bottom one here, among African Americans, it does not sort them along partisan lines. So even among African Americans who might have some affinity for those attitudes, it doesn't sort them along party lines in the way that it does among whites. So it kind of supercharges kind of white identity along partisan lines in a way that it doesn't non-whites. The other thing to say here is that you can really see there's really one religious group. It is white evangelical Protestants. These are typically, you know, Baptist or Pentecostal, kind of more conservative white evangelical Protestants that tend to live in the South or the Midwest. But it's two-thirds of that group that is either in that Christian nationalist adherent or sympathizer category. Latino Protestants are also in majority territory. They also tend to be evangelical or charismatic. So they're kind of borrowing, I think, from some of that culture, and those attitudes show up there as well. Most other groups, though, fall less than a majority in there. So it really is that one white evangelical group that is the strongest group representing that view. The other thing to point out is that this is not a kind of Christian in name only phenomenon, that it is actually coming through the churches. So there's a positive correlation, in other words, between those who attend religious services more often are more likely to hold Christian nationalist views than those who attend seldom or never. So it's actually connected to church attendance as well. One of the reasons why, you know, despite the most obvious thing that claiming, you know, the country to be a Christian nation is an anti-democratic claim. But one of the reasons why this, you know, I spent so much time on this has worried me so much is because it also correlates, I think, to some other fairly dangerous and anti-democratic attitudes. So I'm going to throw some of these up here. I'm going to go ahead and put them all up here. But in the data, we can actually, if you score high on, there's actually six of them here. If you score high on Christian nationalism, you also are more likely to deny the existence of systemic racism. You're more likely to see immigrants as a threat, or to believe in the so-called great replacement theory, that immigrants are replacing American, like real Americans in the country. More likely to hold anti-Muslim attitudes, more likely to hold anti-Semitic attitudes, more likely to hold patriarchal attitudes and support hierarchical gender roles, and then also more likely to support political authoritarianism. All of these things, right, are obviously, for if you're committed to a pluralistic democracy, things that undermine there. And one thing I'll mention here, too, is that the scale just measures Christian nationalism. It doesn't measure race or ethnicity at all, but we can really see the power of whiteness when it is linked up to Christian nationalism simply by comparing Christian nationalist attitudes and Christian nationalism, white Christian nationalism adherents and Christian nationalism adherents who are not white. So that's what this chart does here across just kind of three representative questions. One of these is about kind of denial of systemic racism. The second one is about essentially that great replacement theory, agreeing with that attitude. And the third one is the kind of Muslim travel ban, supporting that question. And what you can see here is we just look at white Christian nationalism adherents, they're much more likely than the general public to disagree with the first one and to agree with the second two statements. And if we look at Christian nationalism adherents of color, they are like by, you know, 20, 30 points less likely to be on the same side of those questions as white Christian nationalism adherents. So you can really see the role that whiteness does. It's the combination of holding these ideas about the country being Christian nationalist and holding more white supremacist attitudes at the same time that are really connected there. The other one I want to make sure I get to here is violence. That we are finding that this maybe should not be so surprising, given that this idea that this country, was a kind of promised land for a divinely ordained promised land for European Christians, was the thing that justified genocide of indigenous people in this country and displacement of them. It also justified the entire transatlantic slave trade. So given that violent legacy, we shouldn't be surprised that we find that same positive correlation. If you hold those underlying views, you're more likely to support political violence today. And that's exactly what we find, that this. Do you agree with the statement? Because things have gotten so far off track, true American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save the country. Those who are Christian nationalism adherents, it's about 4 in 10 who agree with that statement. You can compare that all the way down to those who are Christian nationalism rejectors. It's only 6% who agree with that statement. So really, the more likely you are to support Christian nationalism, the more likely you are to also say that political violence, you know, may be necessary in order to save the country. And I think I'm just going to show you one other thing, and then I'm going to pause here, and we can talk. We can take some questions. I don't want to go on too long. But I do want to just show you a correlation between Christian nationalism and electoral results here. And I'm just going to go with this one. I'm happy to make these slides available here, but I'm just going to go to this one
chart. Please do. Yeah, thank
yeah.
you.
But I'm just going to go to this one chart here, and I'll maybe stop with this one. So what we did to look at the to answer the question, how influential are just a single variable of holding Christian nationalist views on vote choice? And so we went back, this is 2020, but we don't have the final numbers yet to do 2024. We'll do that probably in January when we have the final numbers from the 2024 election. I don't expect they'll be much different. Most of the votes among white Christians were exactly the same in 2024 as they were in 2020. But when we look here and we, on the x-axis here, we have kind of the average score for each state. This is each dot represents a state. So on the x-axis, we have average score on the Christian nationalism scale. On the y-axis, we have percent vote for Donald Trump in 2020. And this is among white Americans by state. And you can basically see this is a scatter plot. And so, you know, our home state of Mississippi, Dr. Marsh there is way up there in the top, right? It is both the highest state with the highest score on the Christian nationalism scale and the state with the highest vote for Trump in 2020. Down on the bottom is Massachusetts, you know, with the lowest score on the Christian nationalism scale and the lowest percent vote for Trump in 2020 as well. But what's remarkable about this is how tightly they cluster. So if you were, you know, many of you may have had your kind of intro to statistics where you see a scatter plot, and this would make a great textbook example of like a positive correlation. It's very tight. There's not a lot of noise. And, you know, the dots aren't, they're very clustered around a central trend line. And it's just very, very linear. Even without the trend line, you could see exactly where it goes. And so this is actually like, you know, about as predictive as you get on it for a single variable predicting vote here. And so it's very like live and operative. And, you know, very predictive of the vote choice that we're seeing today and of kind of partisan identity as well. So I'm going to just kind of stop. You know what? Actually, I'm not going to show you one last thing here.
Please.
Yep. So I do want to
show you. Fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me go to this last piece here. So to kind of go back to, you know, kind of the book, like trying to kind of establish this claim that, you know, what we're seeing today is white Christian nationalism is really just the latest manifestation of a 500-year-old claim that America is the promised land for European Christians. So this exists before we have a country, right? It predates the Republic by a lot. I mean, it literally is the version of Christianity that lands on the shores of this country. So I'm here in D.C., and this painting is in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda today. It's a set of 8 paintings that are kind of around the kind of upper part of the rotunda, and it was put there in 1855, but it's part of a series that explains the founding of America, and so it's entitled The Discovery of the Mississippi by De Soto. So that's Hernando De Soto there and his white, horse and his regalia and his kind of feather in his cap, kind of marching into or kind of riding into this indigenous village. And you, if you kind of look around, what you see is you basically see all the things, right, of Christian nationalism here are of that old doctrine of discovery. You've got, kind of weapons down the lower left-hand corner. You can see guy's got his head bandaged where they've been fighting already with indigenous people. And if you follow it down around, there's a kind of whole cache of weapons at the bottom and helmets. But if you follow it around to the right, in the bottom right-hand corner, right, is the church, right? There is someone reading from the script or probably this requirimento document that is basically declaring the indigenous people that they're claiming the land for Spain, and there is this huge crucifix that's probably 20 feet tall being lowered into a hole and raised up right in the middle of the indigenous village. And then you've got this depiction of indigenous people kind of cowering, you know, in the face of the kind of European might. But this is still, you know, part of the narrative that is in our U.S. Capitol rotunda today, telling the story of how we got here, right? And it has this kind of Christian nationalist iconography, you know, built right into it. And I was struck by this this other image, which is from the insurrection on January 6th. That's about happened about 5 miles south of my house here. And, you know, again, you kind of look at that cross being raised and this cross being raised, prayer being offered. There really are these kind of very strong resonances about what's being claimed and in whose name it's being claimed that just pick up this very, very old story that we've been wrestling with in the country since, again, before our founding. So at the end of the day, I mean, I think that where we are in the country is, you know, we've kind of kicked this can down the road and we've partially answered it here or there. But I think the question is going to be put in front of us very strongly. This question is like, well, so who are we as a country? Are we a divinely ordained promised land for European Christians, this very old claim on the country? Or are we a multi-religious, multi-racial, pluralistic democracy? I think certainly in the next 4 years, that question is going to be front and center as, you know, who we are in the country. It's going to be a very live question that those of us who are Christian, those of us who are not, are both going to have to be called on to kind of, I think, speak up and give an answer to. So I will stop there.
Thank you so much. Bravo, Robbie. That was just so exceedingly helpful. The way I'd like to proceed is to let the students in the seminar ask a few questions and then open it up to our online guests. Yeah. I want to begin by, I guess, maybe raising an obvious question, and it's how your research both informs but perhaps is revised by the demographic numbers of the most recent presidential election. So, you know, after Trump 2.0 became a reality, you would get these headlines like HuffPost saying Trump ran the most racist campaign in modern political history, and Newsweek saying the most diverse GOP coalition since the Civil Rights Movement has just, you know, successfully. So how do you understand those two perceptions?
No, it's a great question. I mean, on the second one, I do have to say the bar is set pretty low for there to be a diverse Republican coalition since the Civil Rights Movement. It's been an over, you know, I mean, one of the remarkable, you know, things about our two-party system is that, you know, I mentioned that the modern Republican Party today is 70% white and Christian in a country that's 41% white and Christian. Democratic Party today is 25% white and Christian. Well, how do we get there? You know, the answer to that's not abortion. The answer to that's not disagreements over LGBTQ rights. The answer to that is clearly when the Democratic Party became the party of civil rights in 1964, 1965, that's when we get to see the great exodus of white Christians from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. And we're still living in that reality. So even if there has been, and there was in this election, and particularly among Latinos, who have a different history than the kind of black-white dynamic that we often talk about, but are this often at the top of our kind of discussion about race in the country. But nevertheless, it's still an over. So the week after the election, the only postmortem piece I've written was one that I wrote for Time Magazine the week after the election, and I called it "What White Christians Have Wrought." And the reason I did that is because, you know, there's clearly we should be looking, and I, you know, in my day job, I get paid to look at all these, you know, who shifted from where to where between 2020 and 24 and why, and like, that's all really important. It seems abundantly clear that Latinos shifted, you know, in this race. That seems to be the biggest thing to kind of wrap our heads around, and we'll all be doing a lot of that over the next year or two in particular. But the other thing to say is that what I wrote, I just didn't want us to miss the forest for the trees, you know, here. So, for example, you know, white women, majority, again, voted for Trump, right? In this, but that's mostly on, are what pushes white women over the top from not a majority to majority are white evangelical women. So without white evangelical women, other non-evangelical white women vote about 45% for Trump, not 52% for Trump. So it's that 8 and 10 support from white evangelical women that kind of even influences that little demographic. And it is still the case. So I know you all read some Niebuhr, although I can't remember, was it Reinhold or H. Richard that you read?
Reinhold. Yeah.
So his brother, H. Richard Niebuhr, wrote a piece 100 years ago called The Social Sources of Denominationalism. And in there, he talked about the racial divisions within Christianity and he, you know, and what he called the scandal of the color line in the Christian churches. And, you know, I would say that, like, one of the things I just want to kind of keep pointing out is there are no two groups in the country who vote more differently than white evangelical Protestants on the one hand and African-American Protestants on the other. They always, if you sort religious groups in the American religious landscape, they are always on the opposite poles. Like, so there are more distance between white evangelicals and African-American Protestants than between them and Jews, than between them and the religiously unaffiliated. They are always the poles. And so what's, you know, what's going on there, I think, and this ought to be something I think particularly white Christians, given our history, take pretty seriously, like that, you know, if we have been wrong on slavery, wrong on segregation, shouldn't it give us pause that we are voting in exactly the opposite way of our African-American Christian brothers and sisters? And that's still the case. It's still the case that if you look at the religious landscape, and you can still describe it ever since basically 1980, which is about when the two parties settled out after that sorting, after the civil rights movement, you could describe the vote this way, that white Christians have voted majority for Republican presidential candidates, and everybody else has essentially voted for a majority for Democratic president. So Christians of color overall, non-Christian religious people, religiously unaffiliated people all voted majority Democrat. And that's been the division. It's been a kind of white Christian Republican leaning group versus everybody else on the religious landscape virtually every election we've had since 1980. And that's still the case. So everybody knows 8 in 10 white evangelicals voted for Trump and has every time he's been on the ballot. But I think what people don't quite realize, and this is one of the things I tried to point out in White Too Long, is that white non-evangelical Protestants vote about 6 in 10 for Trump every time he's been on the ballot. White Catholics have voted about 6 in 10 for Trump every time he's been on the ballot. And so that kind of white Christian coalition is the only reason, right, why Trump ever got the nomination in the first place and why he's ever been elected to any office he's ever held.
Thank you. Several, Sarah and Lydia, asked questions about the sort of ideas or mechanisms, I think is the word you use, that animate the political behavior of white evangelicals. And we're hoping you might speak to those sort of sources somewhat a bit more sort of theologically, I suppose, in this context, or sociologically.
Oh, what's animating them?
What are the mechanisms that drive such views among evangelicals? So what are the sources of their political behavior?
Yeah, well, I think it's a deep sense of insecurity and nostalgia is kind of culturally what's going on there. I mean, you can see it in a whole bunch of ways, but that leads into, and like those are sort of like the more benign, I think, entryways that then lead to kind of more destructive things like anger, resentment, violence. Like, but I think the gateway to that is a sense of kind of insecurity that's kind of linked to entitlement. And I think that entitlement is about, again, the doctrine of discovery, about whose country this is supposed to be, who is this country for, like those kinds of questions. I mean, you know, it was really only a generation ago that, I mean, you know, white Christians would just say out loud, look, this is a white man's country, right? And a white Christian country. That's who this country is of, by, and for. That's fallen a little out of vogue to say it quite that plainly, although we're hearing more and more of that of late. Just saying it out loud, and people kind of claiming, yeah, I'm a Christian nationalist, right? I'm just kind of claiming that term. But I think that's the kind of insecurity and this kind of nostalgia for, I mean, that whole slogan, that kind of Make America Great Again slogan, the MAGA slogan. I think the most powerful word in that slogan is actually the last one. It's not about greatness or America even. It really is again. It's this hearkening back to a kind of mythical, lost, golden age, you know, where white Christians held sway. And there's kind of an ordered hierarchical world that is kind of in that vision, in that MAGA vision. And it had, you know, it had a very explicit order to it. It is white over non-white. It is men over women. So it has kind of patriarchal contours to it. It has racial contours to it. And, you know, America First literally meant that. Like, it's America over everyone else. So it is a clear set of hierarchies and order there that I think is being kind of pined away for. And when that feels like that's slipping away, then I think it's something, you know, that is then the argument is, well, we got to fight, to keep that both figuratively and increasingly, I think, literally have to fight to keep that.
Thank you. Numerous students mentioned how much they learned from your book. Marshall, who just stepped out, said, wonderful book, jarring and intriguing. Dr. Jones did an excellent job outlining in depth how real this problem is, while also ending with some hope for reconciliation, which I find very important. He asked the question, and we've read King's letter from Birmingham City Jail a few weeks ago, and we're all sort of pounded by that passage where Dr. King sort of imagines that he's driving through a small southern town. He's looking at the white churches and their campuses and educational wings and their, you know, kind of public grandeur, and then ask, but who is the God they worship?
Yeah.
And, Marshall said, this is often where my mind races off in disbelief and anger. How would you answer the question that King asked of this story you're telling? Who is the God they worship?
It's a haunting question. I mean, I think it's one that has haunted me and kept me writing, honestly. You know, I named the book that you all read, White Too Long, as you all know who read the book, you know, after a quote from James Baldwin in a New York Times article, op-ed that he wrote after the assassination of King. And he was writing in a similar vein where, you know, he says, you know, the great majority of white Americans have impressed me and have for some time as being beyond any conceivable hope of moral rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm.
They have been white, if I may so put it, too long.
Mm-hmm.
They've been married to the lie of white supremacy too long, you know, and he goes on in his eloquent way. And I think that's the thing I've just tried to hold on to and take seriously. I think it's so many white Christian circles. It's a hard thing to give much space to, right? You want to look away. You want to kind of not hold on to it. But, you know, the only image I have in White Too Long that's not a chart is a hand-drawn image that Dylan Roof, the young man who murdered the worshipers in Charleston at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, drew while he was in prison. And it's a picture of a white Jesus emerging from the tomb. And so I think the answer to King's question is kind of in that sketch. That's God. It's a white Jesus that too many of us, I think, have been introduced to. And if you want to speak theologically, too many of us have been saved by. And to kind of take that seriously and what it might mean, you know, to kind of work out one's salvation, to kind of think about more theologically about the deep, deep troubling implications of that. And, you know, what we know about that young man is that he was raised Lutheran, right? He went to church. He wasn't like an unchurched person. And that image that he drew is actually a fairly recognizable image with all kinds of kind of Christian iconography. So he's not an uneducated, you know, Christian. And yet he called on, you know, for there to be this kind of white supremacist. He called on Christianity to be a warrior's religion and to start a race war. You know, all in the name of that white Jesus.
Thank you. The final question from the group, and I'm going to kind of synthesize that from numerous responses, has to do with the theme of reconciliation. You may be too young to have been a part of these racial reconciliation efforts of the early and mid-90s that, you know, clustered around such places as Promise Keepers, Our Mission Mississippi, are more seriously the work and legacy of John Perkins. And there was a lot of activity and sort of effort in the churches in this towards this end. Reconciliation 101, however, when it becomes reconciliation, you know, 201, collides with political and economic questions. And that's when so many of these initiatives begin to fragment. Looking at the political and ecclesial landscape of 2024, you don't hear a lot about reconciliation. And I'm wondering if you can just offer some thoughts on reconciliation from your work and your research.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that was the frame that I had in my head because of all that work. You know, when I started writing White Too Long and thought that I was kind of writing toward at the end. But as I got into it and it was looking at specific examples and reading other people's work, like Jennifer Harvey, who's a sociologist, has done a lot of work, like looking at congregations who've been trying to work on kind of reconciliation, racial reconciliation initiatives and how, you know, where that's gone well and where the wheels have fallen off. I came to be fairly skeptical of the frame of reconciliation and for this reason, that it seemed to me that at least from the white side of the divide, that most of the time what white people were wanting from black people was a kind of coming together without a reckoning, right? Coming together without, and again, if I want to speak theologically about this, a coming together without real repentance, right? With a true deep sense of repentance. You know, we have kind of models, you know, biblical models for repentance that, you know, like put in the mouth of God, like, you know, there's something between your brother and your sister, don't come worshiping me until you've gone and made it right with that person. Like, there's a material action that needs to take place, not just a kind of verbal, oh, I'm sorry, you know, kind of thing, but there's like material interactions that have to take place, and things like justice and restitution and those kinds of things have to be in play. And I think for so many, like the Promise Keeper models, at least as far as I know, I have never really seen any of those models that had anything like reparations or restitution as a strong part of or as a prerequisite, right, for that. And so in the book, I end up saying, you know, look, it if you're white and you could just do a reconciliation model while avoiding the questions of justice and inequality, it's a pretty good deal. Right. And when we might call cheap grace, right, to kind of dust off kind of a Southern Baptist theological term, you know, that you're getting the benefits without the work there. And so what I argue in the book is I think it's still where I am, that really what, at least from the kind of white side of the equation, what white Christians ought to be doing is aiming at the repair part of the relationship and trusting that if we do enough work of repair, that the reconciliation is going to be a byproduct of, yeah, that work of repair. It's not, we don't aim at it. We don't aim at reconciliation. We aim at repair and doing justice. And I kind of say, look, I think that our African-American and indigenous brothers and sisters are going to let us know when we've done enough of that work that has brought us, you know, into a real relationship that has integrity.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I would just like to note briefly that if you've read the work of John M. Perkins, who is kind of one of the most important sort of post-civil rights evangelical Black activists and writers, you've heard him speak about the three R's of repair, racial repair, reconciliation, redistribution, and relocation. And while those have been kind of deracinated from difficult practices and policies of relocation, redistribution, and repair, in his early years in Mississippi, he spoke of reparations as part of that, the condition of those three R's. And in an interview in Post American Magazine, which I think was a magazine that preceded Sojourners, he wrote, to me, reparations is basically Christian. It might be possible that reparations may be the tool through which many of our white brothers and sisters can creatively express their awareness of the very basic mistakes made since the founding of the country, mistakes like slavery that have never been dealt with adequately by the church. I don't want us to get off on reparations, but I just wanted to note that, because I think Perkins is often kind of sanitized by some of his more, I don't know, let's say, kind of Gnostic followers. For those of you out in the Zoom world, you can either type your question, or if you'd like to ask it, please be concise and direct. So what questions do y'all have? We'd love to entertain questions from this excellent group of online visitors.
So I just wanted to say that you had an excellent lecture, Robert, and I just wanted to ask this question regarding the decline of white Christian America and whether if it reflects broader global trends of diminishing religious influence in public spaces across the United States and Western Europe. From that, do you see parallels between this American version of Christianity and sharp resurgence of Christian nationalism in Europe?
Great question.
Yeah, so really interesting question. The American, there's the kind of talk about American exceptionalism, right, in sociology, specifically to differentiate it from the trajectory in Europe, because religiosity was so vibrant here compared to kind of 20th century Europe in particular. We are seeing, a trend that you might say like looks like Europe, like a secularizing trend. So just to give you those numbers, in the 1990s, less than 1 in 10 Americans claimed no religious affiliation. So like 9 in 10 or more Americans claimed some kind of religious connection. That number today has gone up to nearly 30%. So it's about a little less than 3 in 10 Americans who claim no religious affiliation. That's a high watermark for modern measurements. But like that number would be extremely low for a European, you know, context today. So still like 2/3 of the country claim some kind of religious affiliation, which would be still puts us as a outlier, right, in terms of kind of Europe. The link I do see, though, is that there is this kind of reclaiming of the idea of kind of a dominionist form of Christendom that I see on the rise, both in Europe. You see it in the Orthodox Church in Russia and in Hungary. You see Catholic Church there. You see it like in other ways, but this sense of kind of restoring a kind of white Western, you see the word Western sometimes stands in for white, kind of Western Christendom, right, that has those kind of institutions that, again, it's about order, it's about dominance, with kind of Christianity at the top and everybody else kind of below that. We see that in Project 2025 here, by the way. It shows up here. So that's the links I would say I see between the two.
Thank you. Other questions from our guests?
Are these Christian nationalist ideas sparked from specific New Testament or Old Testament verses, or are they more of like an attitude, like an in-group, out-group attitude?
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting question. Of course, Bible verses are marshaled in their defense, but for the most part, it is more of a kind of an orientation, right? So the thing we're hearing more and more is I use the word dominionist. There's a kind of whole movement now among some of the people who, for example, are in Trump's inner circle, Paula White, Doug Wilson, others that are in this kind of Lance Wall now. They were running these kind of Reawaken America tours in the kind of lead up to the election, that are very explicitly, calling on a kind of reclaiming of a kind of a Christian nation and talking specifically about that Christians should exercise dominion over the seven mountains, right, of society. So whether that's government or business or entertainment, like all of these things that Christians should set themselves up to kind of control these areas of society. So it's sort of a set of theological concepts more than it is, and with a kind of worldview more than it is a set of specific verses, although those verses get, there's verses. And as you say, the other thing that really props this up is music. There's a whole set of music coming out of Bethel, music that hypes up this kind of dominionist theology that's getting sung in choruses and distributed around churches with these more Christian nationalist orientations.
Thank you. Interesting.
Other questions?
Wrote a Doctor of Ministry project on whiteness and moral injury. Just exploring my own experience of uncovering like the Dutch Reformed tradition and the slave trade. And I'm wondering if you think it has any merit. I don't want to approach this with recommendations for healing if what's really at the core of it is a sort of narcissistic entitlement, if that makes sense. If the idea is that white people are avoiding the pain of moral offense by diving more deeply into white supremacy, that some kind of compassionate healing approach is needed, when in reality it's much harsher or more sinister than a wound.
Well, I guess it may be both, right? I'm thinking here of both James Baldwin and Frederick Douglass, who were both pretty clear. Like Baldwin, clearly said on multiple occasions, like, I would never want to be white. And the reason why he said that is not because it wouldn't give him material privileges. It certainly would, right? Entree to, particularly in his day, entree to all kinds of things that as an African-American gay man he wouldn't get. But what he meant was that we've been so trained, and Christianity's been a part of this, to live a lie. Right. And that itself inflicts a kind of moral injury, I think, if I'm understanding your language right here, that there's a way in which, being the enslaver, being the persecutor, and then having to lie to yourself about it, does great psychic and social damage to yourself. And I feel like it's actually one of the things that has kind of kept me writing and digging is to try to figure out how to extricate like my own self from that. I mean, so it's been a pretty personal journey, and so I think it's both.
Thank you. Other questions from the online audience?
I have a question.
Yes, I have a question here. We have a question from our classroom. This is Laura.
Hello. Thank you.
From Waco, Texas.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. On one of the slides where you were looking at the trend line between white evangelical voters and by state, it's also pretty clear that there's an economic trend with that, with like the poorer states voting more heavily and identifying more heavily with Christian nationalism, and I wonder just how you interpret that. I feel like that's pretty clear in lived experiences as well, but I just wonder if you have any insight into that.
Yeah. Well, there's always it's a important question about what's the relative connection between things like economic, and the way it got put in 2016 when Trump was first elected was, well, was it economic anxiety or cultural anxiety? That was the way the question got put there, which I think is getting at what you're talking about. And we did some pretty deep analysis. And one of the things you can do with, a good data set is you can actually control for different variables, right, to make sure that you're not seeing a correlation that's spurious, right, that's actually there because of something else, right? You can sometimes find these, correlations between weird things that aren't really connected. So one of the ways you can test it out is to control for certain things. So obviously income or education are one of the things that you'd want to control for. So in White Too Long, where you read all those models that I used in White Too Long, all controlled for income and education. So even holding those constant, these other kind of connections were still there. I'd have to run it, for that one. My guess is that what it would do is it would influence it a little bit. It might like lower the absolute power, but it wouldn't eliminate the thing. In 2017, we did analysis of white working class voters to ask this question, and what we essentially found was that both economic anxiety and cultural anxiety, and we were measuring that by like these attitudes about cultural replacement and anti-immigrant attitudes in that study. But what we found was that they were both there and both influenced white working class voters to be more supportive of Trump, even when we controlled for income and education and all that stuff. But what we found is that the cultural factors, believing that white people were being discriminated against more than others, holding anti-immigrant attitudes, both of those things, are the immigrants were replacing kind of real Americans. Like those two attitudes were about twice as powerful as the economic anxiety. So they were both there and both independent and all operating at the same time. But the cultural anxiety stuff had about twice the independent effect of the economic stuff. So it's a mix of both. But like if you're going to make a recipe for it, you would include two parts cultural anxiety and one part economic anxiety.
Robbie, we are approaching the end of our seminar. I could keep this going until midnight. You've opened up so many just generative lines of inquiry, but also offered us in the seminar some really helpful ways to bring our work together kind of to a conclusion. Just two quick things, if you don't mind. Do you have access to your email?
Yep.
Could you share, if you don't mind, those two maps of Mississippi and Alabama post?
Yeah.
And I so I want to hear your perspective. As Southerners, as Mississippians, Alabamians, we're very, I guess as we've kind of grown and left and become critical and tried to reckon with many of these historical wounds and social ecclesial pathologies, speaking of the South as a monolith, but I find these blue patterns so deeply moving. They almost bring me to tears. And of course, these are the black belts. Alabama goes from east to west like a little belt. And then Mississippi crawls almost up the entire west border with of course, those counties, I guess that's near Demopolis. Not quite sure what the blue county is on the east. You may know Susan Glisson, Dr. Susan Glisson, in Mississippi.
Yeah.
You look at that map and you look at the numbers of actual voters, and you can see why she's relatively optimistic of for a kind of Stacey Abrams Mississippi project. I mean, the Democratic Party has given up on these states. They offer no money for the ground game. But can you just tell us what those blue zones mean and admonish us to think about those aspects of the South when we speak of the South?
Yeah, well, you put your finger on it. I mean, you know, without looking exactly where they are, but yeah, that little, you know, particularly Mississippi, I know a little better than Alabama, but you know, those two counties on the right of Mississippi just connect up with that horizontal belt in Alabama, right? If you put the states up side by side,
that's the
beginning of that horizontal belt in Alabama. But yeah, I mean, I really do go back to that H. Richard Niebuhr, the scandal of the color line, because thinking religiously, I mean, you know, these people all share the same religion. For the most part, this heavily Christian, heavily Baptist in Mississippi, frankly, state still. And yet you've got these kind of just, I mean, these are just pictures of race, right, in politics in the state today. And that Delta region up there in the upper kind of northwest of the state, that's where Emmett Till was killed, Tallahatchie County. Up there and where Freedom Summer was concentrating a lot of its work. That's what we're seeing, right? And we still are seeing, we still see the legacy of lower voter registration and lower voter turnout in those counties. That's one way the gap could be, kind of closed a little bit. Was it Brandon Presley that ran? You know, he didn't lose by that much,
right?
Actually, and even in a state like Mississippi, he was a Democratic candidate for governor, he was up in the 40s. I forget exactly what it was, but maybe even 46%, I think, he got of the vote. But we're still seeing that legacy. Like one little anecdote here, I remember when I was doing the research in the last book, I wrote three chapters on the Mississippi Delta, and specifically Tallahatchie County. Where Emmett Till was killed. And when I was digging into it, I knew, and everybody knows, that, it was an all-white, all-male jury that handed down that conviction in just over an hour's, or the acquittal in just over an hour's time in the trial of his killers. What I didn't know is that there was not only an all-white jury, but there was an all-white jury pool. Like there wasn't even a single African American who was eligible to be on a jury because there were at that time in 1955 there were exactly zero African Americans registered to vote in a county that was majority black, right? And we're still seeing, we're just still seeing the legacy of that today.
So the final question, Robbie, is, and this is to all of our guests, I think in terms of understanding the confusion of the moment that your research. And maybe you could just send us the website and I will share it, of course, with everyone, is on the cutting edge. And you have helped me sort of get a sense of relative clarity about the kind of religious and political landscape. What I don't still understand, and it seems to be like the area of investigation that has not been adequately pursued, is the funding sources, the map of organizations, entities are providing the resources to make these, to kind of seal the deal.
But yeah.
The ideas promulgated through radio and film and the like, and what happens at the booth. I could have told you 20 years ago, I could have told you, well, this is in the constellation of conservative evangelical entities that are funding these efforts. I don't know where we are right now on that.
Well, I've got a book for you.
Oh, my goodness.
So this is Catherine Stewart's, let me back it up a little bit, book. It's coming out in February.
Wow.
And
that's fantastic, because that's the story we haven't heard.
Yeah, she's an investigative reporter, freelancer, but writes a lot for the New Republic and the New York Times. And she's just a fantastic researcher, and she has connected the dots. And, you know, what's remarkable about it is that's an advance, you know, copy, but it's out in February.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, the kind of map that many of us understood about the kind of Christian right 1.0 back in the 80s and 90s just pales in comparison to the kind of funding networks. And they're now Protestant and Catholic, and they're all intertwined. And it's also the tech bros have married up with the Theo bros. And so there's this whole, like, Peter Thiel, Leonard Leo kind of network that is, and it's, you know, it's connected to the Federalist Society, the Heritage Foundation, and all the Christian right stuff. And it's just, there's nothing like it in the middle or on the left. Really, in terms of the kind of just sheer amount of money that's flowing in, to all of it. So it's just kind of like mushroomed, I think, since, you know, and even in the 80s, I mean, we were all like marveling that, like, just one group, like Focus on the Family, you know, in the 80s had its own zip code in Colorado Springs because it was putting out so much mail. It had a daily subscription base that was bigger than the New York Times. It had a radio reach bigger than NPR, and that was like in the 80s and 90s. But it's a much starker picture today.
Well, when I was working on sort of evangelical attitudes on the Iraq War in 2003, mm-hmm. One of my research assistants put together a file of what we call the war sermons. And, you know, I remember reading 70 or 80 of those sermons that were preached in influential evangelical churches. Good question. What is that book that you just mentioned?
Yeah, I put it in there, yep.
Okay. And I remember reading them all on a Sunday morning. And, you know, some vaguely appealed to just war criteria, but, you know, two of those points weren't adequately fulfilled by preemptive invasion and you know, there's a lot of kind of extravagant exegesis of King Nebuchadnezzar's and Saddam Hussein's standing in the same lineage and
yeah. This
and that. It finally came to Jesus was never mentioned or rarely mentioned as sort of an unwanted guest. It largely had to do with the divine mandate given our president. Our president has discerned that this is the will of God and we will comply. But the point I'm making is that the pulpits were influential. The pulpits don't seem to have any major role in disseminating this new kind of Christian nationalist sentiment. Or at least their importance seems to be much less potent than 20 years ago. What are the most influential kind of aspects, entities in this rise of a new kind of Christian nationalist identity?
Yeah, that seems right to me. There's still a few of them. I mean, like Robert Jeffries at First Baptist Dallas and some others like that are still kind of center tent poles. I think for particularly for more mainstream evangelicals, but I think what's happened is that there is this, you know, kind of network of things that are just not as visible, like podcast networks that have huge followings, right? Newsletters. There are kind of conferences, like these kind of ones that we bubble up that we see, like the Reawaken America Tour, just like little tips of the iceberg.
Yeah.
Where people are kind of all over the country and doing those things. So I think it's much more like that kind of thing. And then, you know, there are all these think tanks, the Claremont Institute and others like that, that are constantly spreading seed money, you know, out to different people to stand up this, that, and the other. And they're taking a kind of like, I think it's because there's so much money, they're able to spread it fairly thin. And so there's like all this stuff just kind of popping up around the country in a way that it's not as, I think what's different about it this time is that it's not as centrally organized, right? You could name the dozen players in the kind of first iteration of the Christian right. And if you had those 12 or 20 people, everything else kind of revolved around them. And it's just more, much more diffuse, decentralized kind of model, I think, at this time, which is why I think her, like Catherine's book is like really helpful, because it does kind of give you the spider web of kind of how it's all flowing out there.
Well, thanks for introducing us to that book. I'll go ahead and order it. And hey, just before we offer our heartfelt gratitude, are you working on anything new these days, book-wise?
I am, yeah. Interesting enough, I think I maybe the first time I've said it in public, so I'll just say it in public. So I'm working a book that I'm tentatively calling Goodbye Columbus, that's the endearing myth at the heart of America's identity crisis. That's looking, it's be more historical work than I've done before, but like looking at the ways that that Columbian myth, and it'll be intersecting, you know, we'll have the 250th anniversary of the country in 2026. So we'll be talking about who we are and where do we come from and what's our legacy. So just kind of unpacking, you know, that myth and connecting it up with the struggles around Indigenous Peoples Day that's been happening in the last 30 years and among Indigenous people as well.
Well, you are a national treasure, and we look forward to that book. We appreciate you. I want to say the two of us need to find time for a meal or a coffee or a drink sometime, because – as I said, you know, we'll probably discover that we are kin. You know, so many things in common. This is an extraordinary afternoon. Thanks for all of you online guests for your written contributions. I have noted them. They have enriched our conversation. Dr. Jones, many thanks again.
Well, thanks. Can I give one little self-promotion thing at the end here? If you would like to follow my writing more, I write every week or so at a Substack newsletter at whitetoolong.net. So happy to have any of you want to follow along there.
Can you share that now?
I put it in the chat. Yeah, so okay. It's www.whitetoolong.net. It's a Substack newsletter.
All right, fantastic.
All right.
See you later, brother. Bye, thank you.
Thanks.